Morning, Yusuf Bema joins us on the line for the weekly segment focusing on Muslim communities in different parts of the world. Mawlana, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi ta'ala wa barakatuh.
Well, how are you this afternoon?
Alhamdulillah, we can't be doing any better, alhamdulillah.
All praise to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Well,
perhaps you can begin by a short recap on last week's segment.
Okay, inshallah ta'ala. Jazakallahu khairan, Mufti sahab. Yes, dear listeners, we are currently discussing Islam in China, and we have discussed in the last two segments how Islam initially arrived in the country of China in the 7th century by some ambassadors of the Muslim Empire, where they invited the emperor to Islam. He didn't accept Islam, but he gave them permission to give da'wah, to proselytize, to invite others to Islam. He allowed them to build a masjid there as well. And Islam was relatively low-key for the first three centuries, but from this 10th century onwards, Islam began to rise with the number of Muslim immigrants who had come to China, most of them as traders who had begun residing in the ports, marrying local Han, and forming what was then to become the Hui Muslim ethnic group. And Islam continued to rise, particularly during the Yuan dynasty. The Yuan dynasty was the mixed Mongol-Chinese dynasty. The most famous ruler of the Yuan was Kublai Khan, who I'm sure most of us would have heard his name at some time in our life. So Kublai Khan was of the Yuan dynasty, mixed Mongol and Chinese background. They were more liberal. They brought in tens of thousands of Muslims from Western and Central Asia to China to work in different aspects of their government, and that really boosted the Muslim numbers in China. Last week we discussed the Yuan dynasty, and particularly the travels of Ibn Battuta rahmatullah alayh, and we cherry picked some of the incidents which he describes in his rihla, in his voyage to China in the year 1345. So we discussed that in pretty much detail, and inshallah ta'ala, for today's segment we'll be moving on from 1345, we'll be moving to the next dynasty. So after the Yuan dynasty, the next Chinese dynasty to rule was that of the Ming dynasty, and the Ming dynasty ruled from the year 1368 to 1644. By the time the Ming had come into power, the Islam had been nourishing in China for approximately 700 years already. And up to this time, the Muslims had maintained a very separate, a very alien status, which had its own customs, its own language, its own traditions, and they had never totally integrated with the local Han population. The Ming dynasty, they had other objectives at hand, and the Muslims during their dynasty underwent acculturation, which is a period of cultural and psychological change, where the behavior patterns of the Han were adopted by the Muslims, and the Muslims gradually became fully integrated into the majority Han society. So while assimilation is indeed very great for people, they had to make many compromises in their dressing, in their names. And suddenly, Muslims find themselves during the Ming dynasty to be completely assimilated with the locals, and basically China has lost that amazing multicultural society that the previous dynasty was so famed for. But nevertheless, Muslims became fully integrated with into Chinese society. One interesting example of this was the change of names. So everybody had Muslim names prior to this, and now when they assimilate, they want to make their names as undistinguishable as possible, and in order to assimilate. So Muslims who were of foreign origin obviously had Muslim names, and they changed the names to sound the most phonetically similar to that of Chinese names. So for example, the name Hassan would be changed to Ha. Just Ha. Hussein would be Hu. Sa'id would be Sa'i. And like this, a number of other names. Muhammad became Ma. Mustafa was Mu. And Mas'ud as well was Mas'ud became Mu. And Mustafa became Mai. So in this manner, names, Muslim names, were now become were changed and become more Chinese. In terms of their dress, they also obviously maintained the covering of the awra, but now it was Chinese dress and not the traditional Muslim dress which they had. In terms of food, they began their dietary or their recipes and the types of food that they would eat would be very much Han type of cooking, obviously with halal meat which they would be using. In terms of architecture, it also changed from more Middle Eastern to very much Chinese architecture. That's why many of the masajid in China today, if one would visit, they are very much Chinese in the architecture. Sometimes to the extent that for a person coming from outside, he'll be quite confused to distinguish between a temple and a masjid, because they are so similar in terms of the architecture. And because of this isolation, immigration from Muslim countries slowed down drastically during the Ming Dynasty. The Ming, however, they were very their policy towards Islam was very tolerant. They gave them all the freedom to practice, but it was just a racial policy towards ethnic minorities which was very much firm, and they actually forced integration through forced marriage. So anybody from any other ethnic group other than the Han would be forced to only marry a Han so that they can be integrated into society. They didn't mind that the Han that they are marrying will be accepting Islam as long as racially they all become one group. So it was a period of somewhat negatives for the Muslims, but it also had a number of positives as well. So on the bright side, the emperor, the Hongwu emperor, he had decreed the building of a number of different masajid throughout China in many locations. The Nanjing Mosque was one which was built by one of the emperors. The Muslims had relative freedom to practice in the Islam in whatever way they would wish. It was just that racially they needed to be very much integrated with the Han. And Islam had freedom, and in contrast, those who were following Tibetan Buddhism or Catholicism, they were very much restricted in their practice of their faith, and Muslims, Islam and the other local religions had full freedom to practice. So Muslims lived during the Ming Dynasty with freedom. There were obviously the aspects of assimilation which was forced upon them, but they had the freedom. And they even had quite a large influence in government as well. The Ming Dynasty founder, whose name was, and I hope I get the Tajweed correct here, his name was Zhu Yuanzhang. He had six Muslims amongst his most trusted generals. One of them was Lan Yu, who in the year 1388 led the army, the imperial Ming army, in a decisive victory over the Mongols, which basically led the Mongols never ever to reconquer China again. And this era is known to in Chinese Muslim history as one of the golden ages of Islam in China, because what was to come thereafter was going to be a lot more drastic for them. One of the most famous Muslims during this period was a man by the name of Zhang He. Now Zhang He is spelled Z-H-E-N-G and He is H-E. He was a Chinese mariner, explorer, a diplomat, a fleet admiral, and he was the court eunuch during the China's early Ming Dynasty. So he was originally born as Ma He, Ma meaning Ma, the shorter version of Muhammad, in a Hui Muslim family. He later adopted the conferred surname as Zhang by the emperor. And he was born in the province of Yunnan in the year 1371. And his father was a haji, somebody who had performed hajj. And his family had claimed descent from an early Mongol governor in the Yunnan province, because there was obviously a lot of integration in the previous dynasty. When he was about 10 years old, the last Mongols of the Yuan dynasty had lost control. The Chinese forces under the Ming had now were given the upper hand, and they had overthrown the Yuan dynasty in the year 1368. And this 10-year-old boy, he is captured, he is castrated, and he is sent to the army with many others as well. In that army of the prince of the Ming, He now distinguishes himself as a junior officer. He's skilled in war and diplomacy, and he makes influential friends in court, and he rises in the ranks until he reaches that of the admiral and a close associate to the emperor himself. So that's how Zhang He now rises to becoming one of the most important generals in the Ming Dynasty. At the same time, looking at the context, the Mongols, they had controlled the Silk Route for a number of years, from the year 1250 right to 1350 for that century, and they ruled China for much of the time as well. But now that the empire had split up and had splintered into a number of small khanates, each ruled by a different khan, there was total chaos, anarchy along the entire Silk Route. Taimur Lung had destroyed most of the cities in Central Asia, Bukhara, Moscow as well was all destroyed by him. And the Chinese are now looking to get their goods and to and import goods from another avenue. So the only other avenue was to go out to sea and to abandon the Silk land route. The Chinese, they had been looking and extending the power out to sea for about 300 years, and Chinese travelers had been abroad to India, to the Middle East as well. There were Indian and Muslim traders who had arrived in China, and now was the time, where the time was now ripe for the Chinese to set out via sea on different voyages to extend their influence on the Indian Ocean and on the traders, more importantly for them. The person chosen to man these voyages was Zhang He, as the fleet admiral, and he commanded a number of different voyages, seven voyages out to the Indian Ocean, and he helped extend the maritime and commercial influence of China throughout the regions bordering the Indian Ocean. And there's a very interesting article which inshallah ta'ala we will read through now. I'm not sure how much of time we have, but we will cherry pick some of the incidents mentioned here. The article appears in the Saudi Aramco magazine, and he details his life to great extent. So Zhang He, as we said, was a Muslim, born in a Muslim family, and now the emperor, he now wants to send him out in the year 1405. And he, the younger emperor, he assembled a fleet so large that it won't be surpassed until World War II. So it was the largest fleet that had sailed the oceans for at least 500 years. And the admiral of all of these seven fleets was Zhang He, and he now sets out on his very first voyage in the year 1405. The figures that are given for the size of his fleet seem incredible, but it is clearly documented by a number of different Chinese and other historians, and there's no doubting them. There were 317 ships of different sizes. 62 of them were just treasure ships, loaded with Chinese produce, silks, porcelains, other precious things as gifts for the rulers and to trade with them. And all of this was manned by a number of people, 27,870 men, including soldiers, merchants, civilians, and clerks. So it is basically a small city that was setting sail from China, going to visit firstly Indonesia, and then moving towards India, and then further west later on. And even more astonishing than the size of the fleet was the actual dimensions of these Chinese-built ships. They were said to be some 140 meters in length. Now, just to put you into context, if you look at Christopher Columbus, who was going to sail in another 90 years' time, he was going to sail transatlantic voyage, that his ship was only about 20 or 30 meters long. And a number of other junks or a number of other ships at the time, at most 40, maybe 70 or 80 meters, but 140 meters wasn't heard of. And this fleet carried a number of these really large ships, some of them having even as many as 50 cabins to house the thousands of people who were undertaking this voyage. And each ship out of these 317 ships, each of them had an official whose job it was to take compass readings. It was really difficult to understand how accurate these could have been, but they obviously, like the Arabs, had used the stars and celestial observation to guide them. the speed was measured by dropping a floating object over the side of the ship and timing its passage along the length of the ship. And that would determine the speed. So they were really people with incredible creativity in trying to work out different aspects of their journey without modern technology. Watches were, for example, timed by burning an incense stick of standard length, and it had a standard length, and how quickly it would burn off, that's how they would measure time as well. So they were, as we said, very creative. So in terms of the voyages, there were seven of them. Jean He, his first voyage, called in at Java, Sumatra, Aceh, Sri Lanka, Calicut, Champa, Malacca, Quilon, and a number of other ports. So he went he basically sailed south to Vietnam, to Indonesia, and then going up to Sri Lanka and to India as well, right up to the west coast into Kerala, into Calicut in Kerala, on the west coast of India. And he took a number of goods with him. It said that he had brought so many goods to the Indian ports that pricing alone took them 3 months. Pricing those goods alone took them 3 months. So that was the first expedition. And the second one was in the year 1407, and he returned in 1409, and this was 249 ships. And here they included Thailand and a few other ports in India as well, where in Calicut it spent 4 months. They finished the whole Chilla in Kerala. The third voyage was in the year 1409, and it returned in the year 1411, and this was only 48 ships but carried 30,000 troops. And here as well he went through the very same ports that he had been to prior to this, Indonesia and India. On the fourth voyage, however, he now decides to sail much further west, where he now wants to sail to Hormuz, which is in Persia, and to the Middle East as well. So he had taken with him a Muslim Chinese by the name of Ma Huan, who was a translator. And Ma Huan, he was born near the city of Hangzhou, and he had learned some Arabic and perhaps some Persian as well from the Muslim merchants. And now he accompanies Zhang He on his voyages. And he notes down all the ports that they visit, and he publishes all of this, his records and his chronicles, when he returns to China, which is obviously a hit for the locals because they've never heard or understood what life in these countries are so far away. And he describes the appearance of the people in each country, the variations in the local customs, and he also describes the trades and the food as well. He was very systematic in his 20 chapters that he's written. He starts in the very east with Champa, which is in Vietnam, and he ends right in the west, which he was the country of the Heavenly Square, which is Makkah al-Mukarrama, where he describes the Kaaba, which is on one of the voyages. He describes how they sail throughout India, on the coast of India, Middle East, and even to the east coast of Africa, where they reach Mogadishu and Malindi as well, which we discussed a long time ago when we began the east coast of Africa. So Jean He's fleet had even reached the east coast of Africa. He also discusses Yemen, where he arrives, and he's very much impressed by the agricultural calendars which are compiled by the Rasuli Sultan. He also describes the production and how great these people are in terms of the quality of craftsmanship in the city of Aden. And this is really remarkable because it was commonplace of the Arab accounts of China, as we discussed last week with Ibn Battuta, that he said that the craftsmanship of the Chinese exceeds that of everybody else. But now this Chinese, he goes to Aden, he goes to this Arab city or town, and he says all the people in the country who make and inlay fine gold and silver ornaments and other such articles, as the occupation, produce the most refined and ingenious things, and which would certainly surpass anything in the world. And he describes a number of other wonderful fruits that he finds there. He describes the markets, the bathhouses, the shops selling cooked food, and even the bookshops which he comes across. he meets the ruler of Yemen, whose name is Al-Malik Al-Zahir, and he sends many gifts to the emperor. Some of them were gold belts. He also gives some exotic African animals. There were some giraffes and zebras, and this was obviously the main hit in the Ming court when they do return. They've obviously never seen anything like this, and the painters would paint these animals for years to come in China. He also describes how he goes to Hormuz, which is the city in Persia, and he describes that, and he describes how that all the people all profess the Muslim religion. They are reverent, meticulous, and sincere believers, and every day they pray five times a day. They bath and they practice abstinence as well. Their customs are pure and honest. There are no poor families. If a family meets with misfortune resulting in poverty, everyone gives them food and capital and relieves their distress. So this is what he says about the Muslims who were in Persia at the time. And thereafter he mentions, and this is really interesting, he says in the very same expedition they detached two junks to revisit Aden. So two junks, they were ships obviously of very good quality, they were detached to revisit Aden, and they arrived in the year 1432. But because the political situation was quite tense in Yemen, they had to go further north, further south down the coast, and they had to offload their cargo after securing permission from the Mamluk Sultan at the port of Jeddah. And Mahuan, he disembarks here, he makes his way inland into Makkah al-Mukarramah. He describes the Kaaba and the rites of the pilgrimage, and he even had a painter do a painting of the Kaaba, which he had presented to the emperor on his return. And he describes Makkah al-Mukarramah during that journey. And the Ming expeditions, they overawed many of the local rulers wherever they went. Obviously, if you see a whole city coming by ship with the most expensive and valuable produce, you would obviously be overawed at that time. And wherever they went, people would remember them for years to come. And the memory of Zhang He and his voyages lingered in the Indian Ocean ports like Calicut and Malacca for a number of years. And even when the Portuguese arrived in the early 16th century, the elderly inhabitants saw these bearded, light-skinned people, and they thought at first that these must be Chinese. So the Chinese had sailed these oceans, but after the seventh voyage, a new emperor had taken control of China, and he felt it better or more apt for the court and for the Chinese for the Chinese government to spend their wealth protecting their borders against the Japanese rather than sending out voyages, and that's what brought an end to the voyages, and which made way for the Portuguese, who are now going to take over the Indian Ocean and the trade of the Indian Ocean a few years later. So because the Chinese had backed off and had stopped their voyages, that's what brought them to an end. And inshallah, we'll end off in a minute, Mufti Sahib. We just got one more point to mention here, that it was really remarkable that the same idea occurred to rulers of both the Far East and Far West. And it's really simultaneous that both of them wanted to extend their empires to bring about a global economy. And it just shows that both East and West were both responding to the same rhythm of political and economic change at the same time. And that basically brings us to the end of our discussion today, Mufti Saab. I know I might have taken a few minutes extra, but I just wanted to complete the voyages of Zhang He and that of the Ming Dynasty.
Yes, an interesting dimension undoubtedly, Mullah, to the history of mankind, looking at the voyages, and I think something new that we've discussed this time around in looking at all the other previous programs. And we now will look forward to continuing the discussion next week, inshallah. Jazakumullah khair. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Mawlana Yusuf Bema joining us on the line from Port Elizabeth. Mawlana, looking at the Chinese dynasties, looking at Chinese history intertwined with Islamic history in China. And it will take us all the way to modern history of China in the coming weeks, inshallah.